My name is Steve Williams. That's some of the details of where I'm from. I'm a research scientist at James Cook University, for those of you who don't know me. And I'm running the NCARF Terrestrial Biodiversity Network along with Leslie Hughes from Macquarie University. And most of you will have been in contact with Yvette Williams, who, in case you're wondering, yes, the names do mean something. Yvette is my wife. We've been working together as a sort of a team, I guess, for more than 10 years now, and we wrote the proposals together to actually get the NCARF network funded. And Yvette's the one that actually does all of the work. Leslie and I just kind of tick off on what she does and take all the credit. So today, we're going to have just, this is just a rough idea. On your tables, you've got an agenda and also a feedback form that we'll get you to fill in at the end of the day. And I guess this is, you guys are kind of the guinea pigs because we're planning on doing this event right around Australia over the next few months. And the idea is to do it at every one of our national hubs, which is basically each state. And this is the first of the events, so this is a learning exercise for us as well as to how we can best utilise a day like today to make sure that the network is working well and is actually giving you guys what you need as well and being useful to everyone concerned. So we thought we'll give a little bit of an overview. First thing this morning, I'll give you a talk a little bit about the national process and how we came to be sitting where we are today. Yvette will tell you a little bit about the sort of the actual activities that happen in the network. And then we've got a series of talks. We've got a few science talks to start with. Hugh Possingham will talk about sort of a state view. Then we've got a few sort of more local examples of adaptation science. And then we've got some talk by a variety of stakeholders. And then we'll have a workshop session too, which is the important bit, to get your feedback in this afternoon. So, why are we here? Well, the idea was, and I'm going to blame Hugh on this idea, it was his idea originally, so basically if it all works really well, I'll take the credit, but if it turns to rubbish, we'll blame Hugh. The idea is that the network is very broad across Australia. It's the idea is to bring together all of the people with an interest in biodiversity and climate change right across in any sort of sector. And it's a pretty difficult ask. When we started out, we did really quite well at getting researchers involved because we're researchers, we knew the people involved, it was quite easy to do that. All along the line, we had the biggest, sort of the slowest uptake because of our own networks was getting people involved from various other stakeholder groups. And so one of the, that was the original idea for doing this, and I guess there's a range of things that we hope to get out of it. We hope to sort of both promote the network, get people to understand what it's about and what they can get out of it, just to increase the contact between the stakeholder groups and the research groups and so on. And there's a number of ways that we've actually built into the network that can happen. And really importantly, we've gone through a whole series of national scale processes to identify what are the issues of climate change for biodiversity and a whole range of other sectors within NCARF. But what that kind of misses, it gets the really broad issues that are broad across everywhere in Australia, but it doesn't capture all of the local issues that affect the people on the ground in a particular national park or a particular local council, a particular NGO group. And so the idea of this workshop is to try to collate all of that at the local regional area. We'll go around Australia. We can do that in each of the states and hopefully come up with something that is really complementary to the national scale plans. It has a lot more detail and a lot more of the real specifics. So we'll see how we go. So, and I guess this is what I guess I want you guys to be thinking of this morning. When you're hearing all of the talks from various people, to be thinking about what you think are the real priorities in the area that you're responsible for. And I guess we've been thinking of that in sort of three different ways. What sort of ecosystem it is that you're interested in, what the region is, the actual geographic area, and what sector you're coming from, whether or not you're a manager, policy, a scientist, whatever. And I guess whether or not you think that there have been some really important omissions in the national scale process, if you've seen any of those results, as I said, what you think of the priorities and challenges in your area, and what research might be needed to actually improve the knowledge that you need to be able to make those decisions. And very importantly too, what are the main impediments to having that done? Now, I mean, in almost all cases, it's money to start with, but sometimes there are other things like communication, just getting across the idea, and often things like that the network might be able to help. So this is the question, and I guess everyone often wears several hats when they come to meetings like this, but I mean, this is the question that we have to deal with in this particular network. We are interested in specifically terrestrial biodiversity and adaptation, which is also an issue that many people misunderstand, the difference between adaptation and impacts. And particularly that happens in the research field. We get a lot of applications who want to do what is essentially pure impacts research rather than adaptation research, which is what NCARF is all about. So I'll start with that question. And I'm going to spend a lot of time on this, about 3 seconds. The answer is yes. There is now so much evidence that I won't waste your time talking about this question. And in fact, there's a really good report that just came out from the Australian Academy of Science, which basically addresses all of the commonly seen questions that you'll see in the media, that the sceptics raise, etc., etc., deal with them systematically and scientifically. It's a very conservative report, so many of the things that they would say in there, I would actually say, are probably a little bit worse than what they say in this report, but at least it's very solidly based in science, and it's conservative, and it's a really good way. It's a good report if you need to answer people who are sceptical. There's been a whole range of other reports. I've just put two up here as an example of dealing with this issue across Australia in all different states, in all different ways. This is just an example of the Queensland one, and one on the interactions between climate change and fire. So there's a lot of literature out there. You've all probably seen this figure about 1,000 times, I know I have. Basically, there have been lots of already documented observed changes. Temperatures are going up systematically. Rainfall patterns are changing. The brown areas are just the areas where rainfall has been decreasing over the last 50 years in Australia. Unfortunately, that also matches up with where most of the population centres are, down here and in Brisbane and over in Perth. And as we all know, we've seen the media constantly about records being broken. You know, the hottest year, the hottest month ever, etc., etc., and increasing extreme events. So what's going to happen in the future? This is just a graph from the last Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, suggesting that we'll probably be seeing something in the order of between 2 and 4 degrees of warming. The IPCC is also extremely conservative. So far, since that report came out, we've been tracking either at the very top or above their predictions in almost every variable that you might want to measure, whether it's temperature, sea level rise, and so on. So far, we're still tracking above the worst case scenario on that prediction. So, just to cap off that without going into any of those details about actual climate change, we're getting higher than average temperatures, more frequent heat waves, more intense heat waves. I guess we had a very graphic example of what the effects of that could be in Melbourne with the fires. There's changing rainfall patterns. It's not always drier. Some places are getting wetter. Increased droughts, increasing fire weather, and the incidence of extreme fire weather days. And many of those reports that I mentioned earlier have sort of quite detailed analyses of that, like the Queensland one tells you how many days over 35 degrees and so on. A higher cloud base, basically as temperatures go up, clouds get a bit higher. It's a physical, just related to the physical climatology, and that has effects with clouds blowing through mountaintops and affecting the hydrology in those mountaintops. So around here it would affect Flemington and so on. So, what we've been interested in is what will those impacts be from those processes on our natural environment. The IPCC have identified globally that out of all of the sectors, that natural ecosystems are probably the most vulnerable sector across, including economics, built infrastructure, etc., etc. And specifically within that, what we're interested in today is what effects of climate change will be on biodiversity. Now, there's already been lots and lots of impacts. Thousands and thousands of publications from all around the world in every different ecosystem demonstrating effects that have already happened and making predictions about what's going to happen in the future. And these are the sort of things that have been already shown to change. Species are moving, they're changing in abundance. They're changing when they do things. Their physiology is being directly affected, affecting the interaction between species and the things they eat and the things that eat them and so on. There's some really important, and I think this is today, this will be a really important topic, which is interactions with other things that are already going on. All of your normal conservation problems, like habitat clearing, fragmentation, weeds, feral animals, all of those things actually interact with climate change in some very important ways, making both of those impacts even more significant than they were in the past, I guess. Things like disease dynamics. So there's been some predictions as to what will happen in the future. This paper now is quite old, came out in 2004, that predicted that we're looking at, you know, 20 or 30% of all species globally going extinct. So I guess what we've been doing in our particular research centre over the last 5 or 6 years has been really to try to test those predictions, to see whether they hold up, and to look at a lot of the assumptions, and to just to try to really delve down and get a lot more robust, or a lot more sure idea of what will happen in the future with estimates of how certain we are about those predictions. And I guess then the next obvious question is, you know, what can we do about it? How can we actually minimise these impacts? And there's really two ways. There's mitigation, reduction of emissions. That's actually getting at the source of the problem, reducing greenhouse emissions, etc., etc. Will happen mostly at the scale of government, international agreements and so on. We won't be going into that at all today. And of course, the other way is adaptation. What can we actually do on the ground that will minimise these impacts? And this is obviously the topic of today. It was the whole reason that NCARF was formed, was to look at the potential for adaptation. That's about all I'll mention about mitigation, really. I think we really need to bite the bullet globally and take that first step and everyone get on board. I guess just to highlight that a little bit, though, this is just a figure that came from that Australian Academy of Science report, and it's really just getting at the fact that this is observed temperature, and this is the predictions into the future, and really all I want to point out in this particular figure is that there can be a huge difference between what we get if we do nothing and what we get with very strong mitigation. And of course, the reality is probably going to be somewhere in between those. And I guess with the adaptation angle is, can we adapt enough to prevent these major impacts that have been predicted? You know, can we really do something to minimise the loss of a third of all species globally? I think we can probably do better than this suggestion. So I guess the reality, as I said, is this is like, I don't believe for one second that we're going to keep it below 2 degrees of warming. We're locked into probably 2 or above already. But if we had very strong mitigation, this is the kind of place we could end up. If we have no mitigation, this is where we might end up. And if we get up there, it doesn't matter what we do with adaptation, it's basically not going to have any effect. It's not going to be possible in any real way for biodiversity anyway. I guess what we're looking at is this scenario, where we have some reduction, we have some potential for adaptation, and this is where adaptation could be really important, because that could make the difference if this is the sort of the gap between no impact and this is what we need to cover with adaptation, basically. So, as I said, that was the reason, that adaptation angle was the whole reason for the formation of NCARF in the first place. It was done as an initiative of the Australian government. They put, I think, I'm not 100% sure about that figure, $117 million, it was something in that order, into the problem. A lot of it was taken up by the Department of Climate Change. Some money went to establish the actual centre here in Griffith. Another approximately $10 million was put into establishing the networks. And another bucket of money went into actual adaptation research funding. Now, not all of that has actually been dispersed yet, and I'll come back to that. These are the key roles. I won't go through them in any detail. You can find them on the NCARF websites. But basically, part of the charter of NCARF is to develop national adaptation research plans in each of the different sectors. These NARPs, just to give you one of the acronyms. And it's all, I guess the whole thing about NCARP, it's all about synthesising, getting people together, avoiding duplication and so on. And from our point of view here, one of the important things was establishing these research networks. There's 8 of these networks. They cover everything from human health, primary industries, marine, and this is the one that we're interested in today, terrestrial biodiversity. The whole idea of what we're supposed to do is to be able to give decision makers some synthesised information that will actually, help with climate change adaptation. I'll skip that. So, how do we go about doing that? So, as I said, Yvette and Leslie and I got together, we wrote a proposal, lucky enough we got the funding. We formed a steering committee, which are the people you can see listed here, some of which are in the room today. We actually deliberately tried to get a steering committee that wasn't just particular experts in climate change, but people that covered a range of geographic knowledge so that they were from each of the different states. We tried to pick people who had different sort of types of expertise and also different expertise in different ecosystems, so that we had coverage of rainforests and arid systems and southwest Western Australia and etc., woodland, savannah. So we tried to get as broad a coverage of those three areas as we could. And I think it's worked so far. We've been really quite happy with the way that the steering committee's worked. We've got regional nodes. Here we are in Brisbane at the moment. We've got Sydney, Canberra, all of the capital cities basically. Very simple sort of administrative structure, if you like. We have the steering committee and we have network participants. At the moment we've got well over 800 people, I think it's about 850 at the moment, from 200 different institutions. Huge resource, and that's recognised now. NCARP was reviewed, and one of the recommendations from the review is just the recognition of the huge resource that's represented by these networks across Australia. We've got, as I said, over 800. In all of the networks, there's like 3,000 people in all of those different fields of expertise associated with the network so far. What we're trying to do now, as I said, is part of the idea of this roadshow is to increase our participation in the local government, state government, NGOs, all of those sort of stakeholder groups. So they were our sort of broad goals with the network. And I've basically got what I call my node BS version of the rhetoric that's in those sort of reports and that. We're just trying to get people together nationally to provide a conduit to share information, an easy way to get information out across almost everyone in the field across Australia, to foster collaboration, and we'll talk about how the network can promote these sort of things in a little bit more detail when Yvette gives you a rundown on what the network does. I mean, one of the things that the Department of Climate Change was hoping to come out of this was to reduce duplication. Someone in the northwest of Western Australia is doing exactly the same thing as someone in New South Wales, to at least get them together so that we reduce that sort of duplication. We try and encourage training and development in climate change adaptation, and hopefully in the end make a difference about adaptation and terrestrial biodiversity in Australia. So I'll run you through an example of how we've approached this in our own research centre, which hosts the network up in James Cook University in Townsville. And I guess what I'm trying to get across with this example is to give you an idea of how we've approached it, and this is only one example of it, but basically to try to get across the whole idea of how we can flow from having some basic scientific data on biodiversity monitoring, how we can use that to understand the vulnerability of biodiversity, predict the impacts in a better way, assess what we can do about it, and get right down to something that we can do on the ground to help adapt to protect that biodiversity. So I'm going to be talking about rainforests in the wet tropics, World Heritage Area, one of the highest biodiversity area in Australia. The area is about 10,000 square kilometres of rainforest. For those of you who don't know, it extends from Townsville in the south up to Cooktown and extends down this mountain ranges along the coast. All of these photos that are looking up here, a lot of unique animals, basically the species that are found nowhere else in the world, most of them, and that was the reason that it's made a World Heritage Area 20 years ago now. So we've been going out systematically sampling in all these areas where there's an arrow, and we sample from the coast, and we sample at 200 metres up the altitude until we get to the top of the mountain. The idea being that, because as you know, you go up in altitude, you go down in temperature. The whole idea is that we get sampling that covers the range of potential temperatures within the region for climate change, for understanding the effects of climate change. We've done lots and lots of surveys over the years on lots of different taxonomic groups, birds, reptiles, frogs, lots of different insect groups, a lot of environmental monitoring, looking at leaf litter processes, all of these sort of things, net primary productivity, a whole range of things pertinent to biodiversity studies. The idea is we're trying to actually assess, you know, what's vulnerable, where is it vulnerable, when will it be vulnerable, because we obviously have to think about climate change on a sort of a shifting target. You know, why is it vulnerable? And of course, if we can answer those things, we have a lot much better idea of what we might be able to do about it. It's really complex. I'm not going to go through this, but this is just a sort of a flowchart that we use to try to think about all of the different aspects that affects how a species might be vulnerable. You know, will it be exposed to a temperature change? You know, is it protected by the fact that it lives under a rock? How sensitive is it? Is it really sensitive to an increased temperature change, or is it actually, you know, likes it just fine at a hotter temperature? All of these things need to be considered if we're going to understand vulnerability and what the impacts might be. Now, obviously, we don't know all those things for lots and lots of species, and so we're also trying to work on ways of just, you know, how important are each of these? We're using a system that's got lots of data that we can then extend that knowledge of which are the important bits of this flowchart across to other systems. To give an example, this is a relatively extreme example, golden bowerbird, which is an endemic bird that's only found above about 900 metres in the region. What I'll show you here is the average results of 8 different global climate models, because there's actually, you know, there's obviously uncertainty in predicting climate into the future, especially with rainfall. Rainfall is really difficult to predict in Australia. So what we've really got here is, this is an average of all 8 different climate models, and as I run this, this is the best case scenario, and this is the worst case scenario, and the real difference is really, if you delve down into what's going on, it's really the rainfall. Over here, it's where rainfall doesn't change very much, or maybe even rains a bit more. And over here is where we start to lose rainfall in the dry season, and the dry season's become a lot more harsh. If we have about 2 degrees of warming, and the associated changes in temperatures and rainfall, you can see that if we also lose the rainfall, it's going to be pretty bad. If we don't, it's not as bad. Start going above 2 degrees though, it starts to become fairly grim for that particular species, and anything up to the upper ranges, well, it may survive, maybe not. If we do that for all of the rainforest species, so this is basically a map of biodiversity of vertebrate species richness in the region, dark green areas are where there's the most species, so this is all of the species in the Rainforest World Heritage Area, this is the kind of sum effect. As you can see, worst case scenario, very catastrophic impact at 2 degrees even. I think this is probably a little bit pessimistic. I don't think it will be this bad based on our physiology and all the other elements of that flowchart that I've put up. I think probably this average result so far is holding up pretty well with all of the testing we've done. But still big impact, particularly if it goes beyond about 2 or 3 degrees. If you sum all of that up and actually also look at population size of the animals, we get this sort of scenario. So if we're realistically looking at something like 3 degrees of global change, this is just to give you an idea, this is a prediction of the number of species that would likely to go extinct in the region. We're still looking at about a third of all species in the World Heritage Area going extinct. About another third of the species would become threatened, and about a third of the species would probably be okay, and there's even a subset of those species which would be better off. They actually expand their ranges. So, getting now to what we're on about today, the adaptation side of things, what can we do about it? And this is a particularly bad system because it's probably one of the most vulnerable systems in Australia, if not the world, and like any mountain system with a lot of endemic stuff on top of mountains. So what can we do about it in a place especially where there's almost all of the species are on the tops of mountains that are going to be very much affected and pushed up the mountains with climate change. So we wanted to look at, is there any places that will actually be cooler, that will protect animals from increasing temperature, cool refugia? Where would they be? How big would they be? Need to be effective to protect things? What species will benefit from those refugia? What will threaten those refugia, and how do we protect and manage them? So, Luke Hsu, who's a postdoctoral fellow in my lab, did a whole lot of really quite detailed analyses about all of the different things that affect temperature on the ground. If you're an animal standing in the forest, what drives the temperature that you're actually experiencing, rather than the climate sort of above the canopy? You know, it's cooler under the canopy. If it's raining, it's cooler. If you're under a log, it's cooler again, etc., etc. All of these are just variables that he's put into the model. We actually end up, and we've calibrated this, we've got extensive data loggers spread all through the rainforest. Very accurate prediction now about what the actual temperature is in the forest that it's experiencing. And we can map that. So we can find which parts of the environment across the region are actually cooler than you might predict just based on the climate. And these blue areas are those cool areas. Now, what we can do then is say, okay, well, where's the World Heritage area? Where are the protected areas already? So let's overlay the World Heritage area, the black. You can still see that there's some of these pink and blue areas that are not in protected areas. And we can also take our predictions of what will happen into the future with biodiversity and overlay that over the top. So now what we've got is these green areas, or green and yellow areas, are where we think the most species will be in the future. The black area is the World Heritage area. The blue areas underneath are the cool places, the refugia. And this immediately starts to suggest some obvious management adaptation options in this system. Here we've got high biodiversity areas in refugia, in a protected area. So these are the really, you know, these are the guts of what we need to protect. And here, I guess the main management things are just to make sure that those places are protected as well as possible. You know, if you're going to put money into maintaining, into controlling weeds, this is the place to do it. These are also where we're likely to get the best healthy populations of most things, and if we actually ever get to the stage of being desperate enough to start translocating species or moving them around, this is probably where they'll come from. But we've also got high biodiversity area in a cool refugia that's outside the protected area, and that's an obvious target that could be a potential for acquisition into the World Heritage Area. It could be for some off-reserve management agreement with private landholders and so on. And of course, also the thing, well, we need to maintain the corridors, perhaps, if corridors are a good thing for that particular reserve in here. Got another place down here, which is again predicted to be high biodiversity in a cool refugia, but it's currently cow paddocks. It was cleared, it's highly fragmented, and this whole block here is mostly with dairy farms. Well, there is patches of rainforest in the middle of this, but it's all very fragmented. And that gives us, basically, if you're going to put money and effort into restoration, this is one of the best places in the region you could do it, because it's a high biodiversity area, it's a good refugia, and so, and it brings in these options again, either acquire the land for conservation, just have agreements with the landholders. This is where we do any restoration and re-establishment of corridors. And that's actually happened now. We've been working with the Wet Tropics Management Authority. They put in a proposal under the latest Caring for Country scheme. That's been approved, and this work is now going ahead, and they're actually working with the landholders and deciding exactly which bits of land they're going to put that money into that restoration. So I guess that's sort of taking you through the whole story, from the regional scale biodiversity data right through to the on-the-ground adaptation options in this area that hopefully will have some positive benefits. We also sort of like, okay, well, that's a system where we've got lots of data, lots of background, lots of research. We had a meeting that was funded by the NCARF network, led by Bob Pressey, and looking at how can we actually sort of formalise this procedure to sort of take into account climate change and conservation planning. We came up with this, which is a sort of a decision flowchart, which I know you can't read from back there, which is why I put them in bigger letters, and basically we just sort of tried to think, okay, what are the decisions that managers need to make about climate change and biodiversity? You know, the first one, well, whatever I'm interested in, will it even be affected by climate change? And if the answer is no, well, no worries, you don't have to worry about it. Is there enough flexibility in what you're talking about in the species or the vegetation type that you're interested in to deal with it? So if it's actually got enough natural flexibility, well, again, no problem. Does it have any capacity to evolve in true evolutionary sense? Some species may actually have enough to do this, many won't. But again, if it does, you're still okay. But then you start getting down to what more likely the reality in most situations. Is there any useful geographic variation? All that means is some places you might get a particular population of a species that's already living in a drier place or a hotter place that has been, over time, has been adapted to those conditions. So that particular population of that species might be a lot tougher under climate change than the vast majority of populations of that species. So, and that can be useful for translocating individuals, for protecting those more resilient populations. Are there any refugia? I've just given you an example about refugia. Again, that's an important consideration because that brings you across. If there are refugia, well then what I was just talking about before, you can manage and protect those refugia. But there might be refugia somewhere else, not with where the species is currently. So is there a suitable climate environment somewhere else? And then that's if the answer is yes to that, well, can they get there? Is there a movement pathway to get to that area? And it gives you a whole range of, I guess there's a range of options there. You can maintain a corridor, or you can restore a corridor to provide that movement path. If you get really desperate, you might want to translocate the species to that new area, actually move them. Very costly, not very, it's had lots of difficulties, it's very difficult to do successfully, but depends how desperate you get. And I guess there's also ex situ conservation in zoos, parks, etc., etc. So I guess what we were trying to do there is just provide a sort of a stepwise, just the sort of trying to put the decisions that you might have to think about in making adaptation decisions. So now getting on to the NARP, the National Adaptation Research Plan. So basically NCARF commissioned these for each of the different sectors. The biodiversity one was led by Leslie Hughes from Macquarie, and these are the other people that were the authors on the NARP. And the aims of that plan was really to identify the important gaps in knowledge and to hopefully set some priorities on what needs to be done in research for climate change in the future. And then I guess identify using the networks the capacity, the people that can actually do those things. So, for those of you who have seen the NARP, I won't go through these in great detail, but these are basically the main priority questions that were identified at a national scale across Australia at a range of different sort of scales of organisation. So, at the national scale, it was things like, you know, how do we deal with the changing conservation paradigm? Basically, I mean, at the moment, for instance, if a species moves across the border because it has to move with a changing climate, generally that state agency would then consider that an invading species and treat it like a weed. If a new species moves into a national park, the ranger would actually generally have to try to control it if they've got the resources to do it. Now, all of those sort of changes in the future are something that's actually embedded in our legislation, and we have to now think about a way of dealing with that in a place where change is going to be constant and ongoing. So that's what that first one's about. And how can we change our current, you know, legal policy instruments and so on to deal with all that sort of thing? What long-term observation systems do we need to monitor the effects of climate change and have it, you know, adaptively feeding back into policy and so on? Getting down to some of the regional issues, you know, what designs of the landscape, what to do with fragmentation, connectivity, corridors, restoration, all these sort of things that affect regional land management decisions. And I guess this 5.2.2 here, I think this is a really important one, and it's been less research. I think this is a really sort of big missing factor in the whole story at the moment, is the interactions between climate change and a lot of the normal stresses that managers are facing all of the time. Salinity, disease, invasives, etc., etc., fire management. That's a really important one. Some stuff on mitigation, socioeconomic trends. I'll just skip through these quite quickly. How to make decisions about what are the best ways of allocating your resources, the costs and benefits, which communities are actually most deserving. And I guess this comes back to the example I presented, that's sort of trying to identify where and what species and communities are most vulnerable. So that's the ones that you might want to put your money into. Or if they're so vulnerable that you don't think you're going to be able to do anything about them, do you make the decision, the tough decision, not to put money into them because you'd be better off putting it into something that you can save? Getting down to sort of local protected areas, how can they adapt and change? And how can we integrate current conservation schemes? Gets down to then managing key species. And that again is that question I would just talk about, where should we put our resources for adaptation? Also something that there's been some research on this, but I think there needs to be a lot more in Australia. There's been a bit overseas, and that's, we tend to, as conservation biologists, I know, think mostly about the things we think are threatened, but of course there's a big need to look at the actual threatening species as well, to be able to model into the future where weeds will go, feral animals and so on. I'll finish up with this, which is basically, there's been a whole lot of reports across Australia, as I said, the NARP only being one of them. There was the BVO, the Biodiversity Vulnerability Assessment. There's been a report done by CSIRO on the Protected Areas Network in Australia. And I guess what I've tried to do here is synthesise all of these different reports into some of the common things that come up time and again in all of these national reports that are important. And they're the same, mostly the same as in, that I just went through in the NARP. But, you know, developing planning strategies to recognise novel ecosystems, shifting species and climates and so on, understanding and predicting vulnerability, identifying the best refugia, understanding the impact of extreme events like fire, droughts, floods, heat waves, the interactions, protecting greater environmental diversity as a sort of a hedging bet against the effects of climate change, maintaining resilience. I mean, all of those things that are the current stresses, as I said, fragmentation, weeds, etc., etc. By managing those, you're actually giving the system, you know, the highest resilience that you can as a manager of your particular local patch, and so that's giving it the best chance possible under climate change. And to manage these landscape issues such as connectivity, corridors, fragmentation, etc. So over the rest of the talks, what we'd like you to do is to kind of have those sort of things in the back of your mind, thinking about, are there things that are missing in your opinion? What you think are the priorities and challenges in your own area of interest and sector, and what research you need to make those decisions in a better way, and what the main impediments are. So that's just a reiteration, and to keep them in mind, and if you've got notepads on the table, take some notes as you're going through the whole day, so that this afternoon when we start to fill in those details, you won't have forgotten all of those important ideas that you had during the day. I can't remember how much time we allocated for questions, but I'll finish there, and has anyone got any questions for any of that?